Hello everyone, welcome back to the show, and today's guest is Nancy Talbot from BLT Research. How are you going, Nancy?
Hello, it's so interesting to hear your accent. Hello, Australia.
A lot say that, and a lot say, especially when I was in America recently, that I've got the most full-on Australian accent they've heard. Some people couldn't even understand me, so I was a bit taken aback by that.
I can understand you, but it really is clearly Australian.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Then we can have a conversation, which is great. Now, you're a well-known researcher in the field, and you have did you start out researching crop circles? Is that right?
My primary interest has been, I had a UFO encounter when I was a kid before, I'm old. Before crops, before UFOs, people understood much about it. And I was fascinated because it was up close in daylight and weird things happened. And I really wanted to understand what it meant. And I found out about NICAP and I joined NICAP and I read everything that they sent me. But after a while, I realized nobody seemed to know what the hell was going on. And I got bored because there was no new info. And so I went on with my life and did other things and And then in the 1990, I guess it was, I ran into the crop circles. I had my first awareness that they existed. And something, I don't know what it was, I really don't, but I instantly knew that it was important. And I also knew, now I'm living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is the center of academic stuff here on the East Coast, Harvard, you know, MIT, Tufts, all these schools. And I had this feeling that it was not only important, the circles, but that if somebody could get some science done, that maybe we could get this in front of a larger, you know, not just those of us who've had weird experiences, but in front of people who have a real terrible time thinking that any of this could be real. And John Mack lived right around the corner from me, by the way, and I knew what he was doing. So that sort of spurred me on to then go and get some science done.
So what was the format when this happened? Like, obviously you've been able to get scientific evidence. How have you got to the crop circles, and how did this play out in terms of getting the scientific evidence for research and be able to show the evidence?
Well, I had some money. I'd been successful in my, I used to promote bluegrass festivals, and I'd made some money. And I also was diagnosed with cancer. And they were telling me that maybe I was going to die. And I'm thinking, first time in my life I've ever had money, right? And I'm not about to die with a bunch of money in the bank. So I had heard about this guy, Levengood, this biophysicist out there in Michigan, who was already looking at the plants. He had heard about the circles too, you see. And so thinking that I might not be around for too long, I decided, okay, I'll use this money to set up a you know, find field workers in all the different countries, because I had enough money to be on the phone with them to, you know, to do whatever I had to do. And I developed protocols as to how they should test the circles, how they should take samples, what they should do with them, how they should be packed, you know, all that stuff. And so that's what I did. I just started doing that with for Levengood so that these samples could come in, you see, from countries all over the world. And they would be sampled by sometimes truck drivers, sometimes PhDs, sometimes agricultural field reps. I picked every kind of person I could think of, again, to avoid this thing called experimenter bias.
Yep.
You know, the debunkers will say if you're biased, then you only sample the stalks that show you. So I made a protocol where people couldn't do that. They had to take samples every 5 feet, period, you know, or every 3 feet or every 10 feet, whatever. And we developed, I had this huge group. There were like 250, 300 of these people around the world, all of whom were interested. And they would call me when they a crop circle happened. And I decided, and nobody but me did this, Levin Good was not involved. So when you hear no double blind stuff was done, that's baloney. I was the person who decided which ones we were going to sample. And each year I would change the number. One year I'd say, okay, every fifth one I hear about, we're going to sample. The next year it could be every 10th one or every second one or every eighth. Nobody but me knew that. So again, no bias. I was simply picking the fifth one that came along or the 10th one or whatever. And then I'd tell those people to go ahead and do the sampling. Or if I could get there, I would go and do it myself. And eventually all these plants and eventually soils then were shipped to the lab in Michigan. Levin Good had never seen the circles, of course. I mean, he couldn't have been more blind if his life depended on it. And he simply got this stuff. It would come in the mail with the field diagrams, with all the measurements, and hundreds, in fact, thousands of plants, and hundreds of soil samples, which he then would spend weeks, even months, working on. And over the years, we developed a number of, or he developed a number of methods that we, because we were seeing the same things. He noticed after a while that there were certain changes, abnormalities in the plants, and then later in the soils, in circles all over the world. If they were genuine, they would have these same things. And so slowly but surely, we figured out what the major things were to look for. And I'll send you a picture. The very first, there are two visible signs in crop circle plants, only two that are visible that have been scientifically determined, you know, as part of the real thing. And they are apical node elongation and expulsion cavities. And I'm going to see if I can, I think I can figure out. How do I do this? That's how I do this. Wait a minute. So I can send you these pictures so you can show people. So the very first thing which we find all the time in genuine circles is something that it's elongation or stretching of the apical node. Now, the apical node is the top node in the plant. The first node beneath the seed head. And what happens there is that node becomes stretched much longer. And I'm going to send you now another one. Okay. I think I am. God damn, I can't remember. This drives me. Okay, there it is. It's under conversations. Sometimes it's so hard to remember. I wish I'd done this before. Okay, here's an example of extremely elongated apical nodes. Now, what's going on here? The top node of the plant is the youngest part, right? The fibers there are very elastic. They stretch. And so when the energies which are involved, in this case, we're talking about the microwave component, when those energies hit these plants, there's water, you see, inside the plant stem. And the water is collected mostly at the nodes. You see those arrows that show you where the apical node is?
Yeah.
Okay, that node is, they're all down the plant. There'll be three or four in each plant. But that's where the water, the most of the moisture is collected. So what does a microwave do to moisture?
It would evaporate or cook it, wouldn't it?
It turns it to steam.
Yeah.
I mean, if you stick a potato or an egg or something in your microwave oven, the microwaves heat up the moisture inside the potato or the egg, and that's how it gets cooked because it's turning the moisture into steam. That's exactly what's happening in the crop circle plants. And as the moisture turns to steam, steam expands. It's got to go somewhere. Well, in these top nodes, because they're elastic, what happens is those nodes stretch and they let the steam escape. And once the steam is gone, the nodes are left in this stretched position. and they stay that way. So anybody going to a crop circle who wants to have some idea, are they looking at a real one? The first thing for them to do is grab a bunch of controls from out in the field, take them into the circle with them, get down on their hands and knees, and start comparing. How long is that apical node in the flattened plants compared to the controls that they brought in? And now a lot of times the elongation is not so great that you can tell it visually. Sometimes it's very great, sometimes it isn't. But the point is that if you take enough samples, we can do the measurements, and then we can find out statistically, are they longer in the flattened plants than the standing?
That's fascinating.
And if they are, that's a sign that the microwave radiation has heated up that moisture and he stretched those nodes as the steam tried to escape.
Escape, yep. No, I can see that right now, and I'll put that up for the viewers as well.
Okay. Now, the second thing that happens, caused for the same way, again, the microwave radiation, there are multiple energies involved. Microwaves are just one. But the microwaves do something else. Farther down those plant stems, and I've sent you the picture now of this, the stem is tough. I mean, that's how the plant stands up, right? It would flop over if it wasn't tough.
Yeah.
So the reason that farther down the nodes do not stretch, it's because the fibers are so tough. And so there, the microwaves turn the moisture in those nodes to steam also, but it can't get out. It can't stretch. And so what it does, not in every genuine circle, but in many, it blows these holes. We call them expulsion cavities. And what you're seeing there is in the field, those are expulsion cavities in wheat, in a crop circle in England that happens to be. And you see, they're holes. They're perfectly visible. I mean, anybody who takes the time to get down on their hands and knees and look a little bit, if those holes are there, they will see them. And both of those things are related to the exposure of the plants to the microwave component of this energy system.
Fascinating stuff. What else?
I'm going to send you two more pictures from England that'll just show you whole bunches of these, the apical node elongation and the expulsion cavities. And this is just one sample. People can, they go to the website and go, wait a minute. Oh, what the heck is the second one there?
And that's at www.bltresearch.com.
Right, so and if they go to the field reports section, they will see hundreds, well, dozens and dozens and dozens of photos, because we did a lot of work in England in 2009, and we took hundreds of plants and hundreds of controls, and then we put this all together so people could see with a picture of the formation in the middle. So you know which formation we took them from, and you can see the sample plants, and then you can see the controls. The controls are always the plants outside the formation and usually a good distance away. You don't want them, you don't want your controls close. You want them 50, 100 yards away if possible. And, you know, when it's there, when these two visible signs are there, you've got a very good indication that that particular crop circle is the real McCoy. Now, we would do in the lab more tests. There are multiple other tests we do that you, things you can't see with your eyes in the field itself.
Yep.
But when we do, when we have these two things and then we do the other tests and they all come up positive too, we have, I think, about a 99% accuracy rate in knowing that that particular crop circle is not mechanically flattened. We've done a lot of control work where we have made circles ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, we've tested those. You never see apical node elongation. You never see expulsion cavities in the man-made formations.
So there is a complete difference when you look at the scientific evidence between the man-made ones and whatever's making these. And in saying that, what do you surmise is doing this? Like, obviously something with high energy, because we look at some of the evidence too, and it's like anything else would be demolished, burnt, you know, the way this is done. And these things aren't, but yet moisture's, you know, basically come out of these things steamed, and there's orbs seen in the area when some of these copper circles are made. What's your theory on what's doing this?
Well, it's of course complex, but basically there are two sets of important work. I've just sent you the thing that shows about the microwave, the range of microwave, and that the microwave component is what's causing these two changes we've talked about already. However, there is evidence, and you really have to read the website to get this in detail, but we've been able to prove that very unusual electrical pulses are also involved. We know this from another kind of testing we do, and strong magnetic fields, and that's from the soil work primarily. Now, those energies, microwave radiation, unusual electrical pulses, and strong magnetic fields are known to be associated with a discharging plasma. A plasma you would recognize, a discharging plasma that you see all the time, particularly down your way, is lightning strikes. That's a very high energy plasma discharge. A much lower energy plasma discharge would be the Northern Lights. I mean, these are common, right?
Yeah.
And recently in science, in the last 20 years, pilots have known this for ages, but the scientists, they're always kind of behind some people. And the scientists now know that there are blue jets and elves and red sprites. These are all plasma discharges in the atmosphere, not too high up above the Earth's surface. What Levengood suggested, his idea, his theory, was that the circles were being caused by an as yet unknown type of plasma discharge, one that was actually reaching the crop surface, but was nowhere near as intense as a lightning strike. And since, in the last 15, 20 years, three new types of plasma have been found, the blue jets, the elves, and the red sprites, they've all just been identified in the last 15 years, there is some logic to what he's saying. You know, that an unknown type of plasma, one not yet understood by science, is maybe causing the crop circles. And that's fine as far as it goes. It kind of lays a foundation. But it's just the first step.
Well, it doesn't explain the geometric patterns and all that sort of stuff. That, because obviously something intelligent is doing this, even though we get geometry and stuff in nature. This is sort of where it goes, doesn't it?
Wait a minute. Many. First of all, two things you got to take into consideration here. Many of the ornate, complex, intricate crop circles that you may be referring to are man-made, period. That's true. Hate to tell you, but it's true. Some of them are not man-made. Some of them are real. Now, microwaves and all of these energies, plasmas behave in some fairly predictable manners. And plasma discharges in the laboratory, there's a scientist whose name is Atsuko in Japan, who is working with plasma in the lab. And one of the things he demonstrated in his tests, he was discharging low-level plasmas in his laboratory, and the discharge would go up against, I don't know whether it was covered in soot, a piece of paper covered in something. And the designs that appeared in the lab over and over and over with nothing more than a plasma discharge being involved, looked exactly like most of the early crop circles. This is simply a fact. You can create those designs spontaneously in a laboratory if you're messing around with plasmas and creating, you know, you're creating plasma discharges in the lab. So we know that many of the designs, moderately intricate designs, do in fact occur under controlled laboratory, you know, situations where nothing else is going on but a plasma discharge. However, that is still is, of course, only part of the story. The fact is that some of the very intricate things are genuine. The fact is that many people have premonitions that are turning out to be very accurate, you know, before. I remember Busty Taylor telling me years ago that he was flying over a field in England one day, and he looked down and saw a real pretty field, didn't have anything in it. And he thought to himself, damn, that would be a great place for a crop circle. Next day, he's up in the air again, flies over the same field, and there is a crop circle. This kind of thing happens all the time.
Yeah.
And so this suggests that perhaps natural earth energies involved in a plasma discharge may be involved, but they are not the entire story. There seems to be what I'm calling, because I don't know what else to call it, a consciousness component, that not just human consciousness. I think human consciousness is involved, although I don't understand exactly how. But I also think from my work with Robert Vandenbroek in Holland, you know, and my experiences there, that there may be multiple other consciousnesses, some of which are identified or related to UFOs, some of which are maybe interdimensional, some of which may be spiritual or, you know, spiritual in nature, some of which I don't know. It looks like there could be a wide range of other consciousnesses which are involved in, as you know, because of your own experiences, interactions with humans on Earth, and the circles may be simply one of the ways that these other consciousnesses are trying, and in the circle situation, it's a very gentle way of encouraging people to open their minds to this larger, the potential of a larger reality, something that most of us, the mainstream, doesn't yet really know about.
So
that makes sense.
It does make sense. It does make sense. So with all the research that you've been able to make available, people can go to www.bltresearch.com and they can see more of that there. How intense and how much time is the research, and how's the funding got about? Because obviously it does take a bit of money to be able to do this. Is it just people contributing to the research team to be able to get this done?
Well, in the beginning, like I told you, I had some money, and about $470,000 of my own money, which was my retirement income, is now shot to hell because I spent it on getting a lot of this work done.
Good.
Then a dear Mr. Lawrence Rockefeller, I mean, I know people have all sorts of ideas about the Rockefellers. The only one I know is Lawrence, and he's the one that gave me a wonderful grant and made it possible for us to do a study, which is perhaps, I send it to you, it's called XRD. You'll see it's, you've already got it.
Yep.
That study is perhaps the most comprehensive, I guess we would say, because we were looking at clay minerals, very specific clay minerals in crop circle soils. And that's all we were looking at. That was our, that was the point of that study. And what we wanted to know, because I had a friend, a geologist, who had told me that if Levingood was right, that there was heat of some kind involved, and we were sure that there was heat, she thought maybe it would also affect the clay minerals in the soils. And so what I did, once Lawrence gave me the money, was I hired totally independent experts in certain fields. Levingood did the plant work like he always does. He was the only one of all the scientists who had ever even heard of a crop circle. I then hired an X-ray diffraction specialist on the West Coast who never heard of crop circles. I hired an MIT statistician to do the statistical work. And then I had the good fortune of getting the world's authority on clay mineralogy at Dartmouth College, which is not very far from me, Dr. Robert C. Reynolds Jr., who literally writes the textbooks and he was the head of the Department of Earth Sciences at Dartmouth and an expert in clay mineralogy. And I was able to get him to evaluate our work. You want somebody who really knows their stuff when you come to doing this kind of thing. So we did, you know, we found a circle in Canada that looked like a very good candidate. It was way off in the boonies. Nobody had been in it. It was brand newly discovered. I had a good field work team up there that had never done the work before. So all they did was follow the protocol. Then the plants were sent to Levingood. The soils were sent to the X-ray diffraction guy. Levingood did his work like he always does. The X-ray diffraction guy pulls the clays out of the samples and then runs them through the XRD machine. That's all he did. Very expensive, mind you, but that's what he did. Then he gave his results, the XRD guy. Levingood gave me his results first. Then the XRD guy sent me his results. Then I took those results and sent them to the MIT guy to get the statistical work done. Remember, these people, they don't know anything about crop circles. They're just getting a bunch of data and they're asked to do certain statistical evaluations because we want to know if the results are meaningful. Are they significant? So he comes back. We thought we didn't have anything. The statistician guy comes back to me and he says, well, the X-ray diffraction results do show a statistical difference between the clay minerals inside the crop circle and the clay minerals outside. So that's great news. Then he tells me, not only do we have it at the 95% level of confidence. And this is what science requires. Well, that just tickled me half to death. And so then I asked him, all right, we got the clay thing that we were looking for. Now I want to know, do the plant changes, did they occur at exactly the same sampling locations as the soils? Because every place we took plants, we also took soils. And I knew the plants had massive changes in them, but I didn't know if those same sampling locations had the soil changes. So the guy ran what's called a regression, and he finds out, yes, they do match, and they do it at the 99% level of confidence. Science doesn't get any better than that. Now, what that tells you, what it strongly implies, is the way scientists would put it, that whatever caused the changes in the plants also caused the changes in the soils. But we got a big problem with this. I take it to Dr. Reynolds at Dartmouth because I want his opinion. And he says to me right away, oh, no, 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 no. This can't possibly be so because this only occurs in sedimentary rock. It has never been seen in surface soil before. And so he wanted me, he said, can I do the work over? Meaning, would I send him all the samples so he could do it on his own machine? So I did, and he did. And he gets the same damn answer we got. So then he thinks, well, maybe the statistical work isn't right. So he redid all the statistical work. And he calls me back, and darn, he's got exactly the same results we got. So at this point, this guy was brilliant. This man really was a brilliant scientist and very gutsy. He knew the crop circles were considered weird, and his colleagues were telling him not to mess with me, not to work with me. But he was so intrigued by what he saw that he blew them off, and he went ahead and did work with us. He told me to do a bunch of other things. He had some ideas that might be pertinent, asked me to do these other tests. We did. When we were done, there was no other explanation other than the crop circle, whatever made the crop circle, did both of these things. It changed the plants and it changed the soils. Now, he told me that, okay, the change in the crystalline structure in the soils only occurs in sedimentary rock. That means mountains literally pressing on sediments. Mountains. I mean, I'm not, you know, I mean real mountains. And we're talking hundreds or thousands of years. That's how this change normally occurs. So he thought, well, obviously pressure could not have been present because it would have smushed the plants into nothingness, right? I mean, there'd have been no plants left.
Yeah.
So then he says to me, well, maybe, he doesn't know, but maybe heat. And he's talking 600 to 800 degrees Celsius for hours, many hours. Maybe that could do it. But that couldn't be the answer in this case, because what would that do to the plants?
Yeah.
It would burn them up. And they weren't burnt. So after all of this work and a final X of things we did, he says to me, well, and he wrote this down, and this is all on the BLT website. He says, given the facts that we have in front of us, which he had double-checked himself, we must be looking at an energy, a causative energy, unknown to science. Now, that's a very heavy statement coming from a man of his caliber, of his reputation. He didn't know it. Neither did I. Neither did any of the other scientists, because I didn't find this out until I was had finished writing up the report for Rockefeller. But I got a call from the field workers. This is 2 years after now. It took us that long to do the work. And I get a call from the field workers who tell me that all of a sudden they have discovered that there are at least 6 witnesses, eyewitnesses, to UFOs, as they put it, playing tag, over that field just before the circle had been discovered. So when dear Dr. Reynolds tells me an energy unknown science, I think he said maybe more than he meant.
It opens up a lot more questions again, doesn't it?
That's the way science works. Mm. Every time you really find something, it just opens another can of worms. But that's kind of the fun of it. The adventure never ends, you see.
Now, you've done a lot, as we've just heard, into the crop circle field, and we've got just under half an hour left. What other research have you gone into in later years?
Well, and we still do some plant work. I mean, we've got, thank Dr. Levengood, I mean, not doctor, it's Mr. Levengood. Levengood didn't have a PhD, so if you're a doctor, that's incorrect. He had 2 master's degrees, and everybody calls him doctors, and I sometimes slip too. Levengood passed away a couple years ago, and since then we have a number of other plant consultants who work with BLT, and they do continue to do some work. But the bulk of my energy the last couple of years, last 18 years for heaven's sakes, has been working with a Dutch medium, Robert Vandenbroek, whom I met because, first of all, he's the only person at the time and still known to, he knows when the circles in his area are coming. Sometimes he knows as they are forming. He will know where they're going to be, what field. He knows what they're going to look like. And I've been with him summer after summer after summer. I got involved because a huge light ball had come to his house. He lives in the southern part of Holland, very rural, lots of farms. And his house backs right up to a farm field. And there's a little balcony that was off his bedroom there. And one night, this huge ball of light had appeared rotating in place outside the balcony doors. And we're talking floor to ceiling glass doors that go out to the balcony. scared him half to death. He and his sister go running downstairs and get the parents. And when they came back up, the ball of light was gone, but there were burn marks on the eaves up above the balcony, and there were burn marks on the outside of the doors, and a pile of white powder sitting right smack in the middle of the balcony floor. Robert's father was a banker, not into crazy stuff, as you can imagine, and he wants a scientific answer. And so I get called to see if our scientists can do an analysis of this powder and tell him what it is, you see. And we did. I said, sure. So it was sent to us. And some of our, Phyllis Budinger, actually out in Ohio, she's an analytical chemist who is another one of our consultants. And she did the work and was able to identify the material. What was interesting, it was magnesium carbonate. And what's interesting about it is not that it is magnesium carbonate. Magnesium carbonate is, you can find it everywhere. It was the purity level. It was 99.99% pure. We have subsequently had many, many incidents of white powder, the same white powder, appearing in some of the Dutch crop circles, appearing inside Robert's house in conjunction with other weird events. And in every case, we've done X-ray diffraction, we've done isotopic analysis, we've done infrared spectroscopy, we've done mass spec, every test you can do on this substance. And it repeatedly comes up as laboratory grade, meaning it's produced in a laboratory somewhere, 99.99% pure hydromagnesite. You and I can't go and buy this. Nobody, you'd have to be a scientist with a lab permit to go and buy this from a specialized laboratory. How in the world and why in the world it's appearing around his crop circles, you know, we don't know. We simply know that it is, and we know that none of us, I had to get some control samples in our tests. I had to try, you know, controls. And I couldn't buy them. I had to get a science friend of mine, a PhD guy, to go ahead and buy the controls for me so that we could then do the work. They wouldn't let me, because I'm not a PhD, buy the sample. So I know damn well Robert can't buy it because he never even got out of school.
So that's something strange right there, especially the purity of it, like you're saying.
The purity of it is, it absolutely means it's highly, highly refined. Now, other events have occurred. I saw a crop circle form. I've seen two of them form in front of my face in Holland. I'm looking now for the image to send you. But I have seen two. And here's the one I'm trying to send you. One of the things that you learn when you've had, okay, this is the illustration for the first crop circle I saw happen. And I'm looking right out those same balcony windows that I just talked about where the white powder was. But in this particular incident, what had happened was Robert and I had been out in the fields. I was doing magnetometer work for Dr. William Roll that year. And I was trying to find some sort of magnetic anomaly in the crop circle fields, you know, where the crop circles were, and in that field behind his house, because crop circles come up there all the time. And I couldn't find anything. I was so discouraged. It was hot and I was sweaty and I'm lugging this damn machine, you know, over dikes and across. I mean, it was a pain in the neck. And we got nothing. I mean, nothing, nothing, nothing. So I'm very distressed. And we're sitting in his kitchen after like 3 weeks of doing this one night, and there'd been a new circle and he wanted to go back to it and take pictures because he gets really weird pictures in him, you know? And I was so disgusted. I said, actually, damn it. This phenomenon is too hard to study. I am sick of it. Why can't it be more direct? I'm going to bed. And I marched myself up to that bedroom, opened the windows wide because it was hot as the dickens, get into my nightgown, and I'm going to read a little bit before I go to sleep. And all of a sudden, I hear the cattle down at the end of the road, they start to bellow. And I'm sure you know that cattle don't bellow at night unless something's bothering them. And I know, because I've talked to hundreds of landowners now where circles have occurred, that if they have cattle or horses or dogs and a circle's getting ready to form, the animals will go nuts. So my first thought was, uh-oh, something's getting ready to happen, because I had never heard those cattle before. And I'd been there several times by then. But I kept on reading. I knew if I went and got on that, I thought if I go on that balcony, I'll see everything happen. But for some reason, I didn't. And about, I don't know, 10 minutes maybe or so later, the cattle started again. And they were really screaming this time. And I knew they don't make noises like that unless they're upset. And I knew. So I started to swing myself out of bed to go to the windows to stand on the balcony, you see. Before I could get my feet on the floor, this tube of light came crashing down. I mean, with a kind of force. It's like a train coming down a track. If you're sitting on the track, that's what it felt like. It lit my room up like daylight. It lit the field up. I could see a half a mile away, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was a straight tube. It was not jagged like lightning. We're talking a perfect column. And it only lasted for a couple seconds, and then it stopped. No noise, no smell, nothing else weird. And I'm thinking, gee, did I just see that? And before I can move anymore to get farther out of bed, bam, here comes another one. And then a third one. I mean, all within 7, 8, 9 seconds. Bam, bam, bam. And I was struck with the precision. I didn't have to get out of my bed to see this happen. I had just said, why can't they be more
More direct,
direct?
yep.
And here it is happening, and the closest crop to my bed happened to be a string bean field. I mean, it's only 90 feet away, right out the back of the house. And I don't have to get out of bed to see it happening. And so I'm thinking, be careful what you ask for in the future.
Oh, yeah. That's what
But
I've told a lot of people. Be careful.
be very thoughtful about what you ask for. Because it appears, I mean, I was in Holland. Nobody knew exactly where I was. I travel a lot. No one, no human, anybody. And I don't carry a laptop or a cell phone or any of those things that would help people locate where I am physically. I don't use any of those things. So no one, except for Robert's family, could possibly have known where I was at that moment. I could have been in any of those fields because Robert and I had been out in them all night long. I could have been in the car. I could have been eating French fries. I could have been anywhere. No one could have rationally known where I was when I said, you know, why the hell can't it be easier to, why can't it be more direct? Nor could they have known exactly where, what bed I was sleeping in. There were many bedrooms in that house. And yet this thing happened in a way. At the time, Robert saw it. He was downstairs in the kitchen, and he saw it all too from the downstairs. And we went running out immediately to the field to see, and I could see steam still rising from it. There's dew at night, you know, that covers the plants. And I think what I was seeing was the dew evaporating off the plants. But there was this big oval with a long thing that went off it and a crossbar exactly like the capital letter T. And what's my last name? It's
Talbot.
Tuck.
They got a
So
sense of
Robert,
humor.
he says to me, that one was for you. And at that time, I was still so focused on the science, I didn't believe him. I thought that was kind of a romantic notion. I could simply couldn't believe. I still have trouble thinking that it's real, because how in the world could whatever this is either know about me, or if they know, care? I can hardly absorb that idea, you know. But now I'm much more inclined to think that, yeah, that one was for me. And if for no other reason, because once you've seen a couple of these things occur, and once you've seen something like that occur right in front of your face, there is not one person on this earth who who could tell me that all crop circles are mechanically flattened by blokes from the pub. You know, I know that's not the truth, because twice now I have been present. One, the second time it happened 30 feet in front of my face, and there was nobody there but me and Robert, and we didn't make them. So, you know, I know. And when I have all the science work, it also tells me very, I knew it from the science anyhow, but now I also know it from having seen it personally, and I know it from years of being with Robert, and he doesn't drive a car. I'm there, I'm the one with the car. He does not drive, and he's afraid to go to these fields alone because he's afraid of the farmers. So when he gets a feeling that something is coming, he'll sometimes draw me a picture. Sometimes we just jump in the car, but I'm with him right there. And I've been with him 24/7. His bedroom is right next to mine. I know where he's been for the last 3 weeks because he's been with me, you know, except when he's sleeping in his bed, and he can't get out of his bed unless he walks by my bedroom. So, and he has nowhere to go if he did, because all he's got is a bicycle. So I know from all of these experiences that there is a genuine phenomenon. I have many reports on the BLT website of other people in other countries who have witnessed circles happening, and often in conjunction with UFOs. I'm going to send you a picture now of a wonderful guy I met in Poland in one of my trips there. And I was able to interview this guy. He had seen a UFO make a crop circle right in front of his face. And this is in the boonies in Poland. We now have some wonder. In fact, we have a wonderful report on the Robert Vandenbroek page on the BLT website. It's bltresearch.com/Robert. That's R-O-B-B-E-R-T .php. And then people have to look down beneath my introduction and you'll see lots of individual reports. And there's one from 20. It's two eyewitness reports in one report. I put them both in the same, because it was Robert's friend Stan who in 2008 witnessed light balls making crop circles with Robert. The two of them were together. But then in 2013, the two of them, Stan was with Robert that night, saw an actual UFO, a hard-bodied, solid UFO right over the field, letting down light balls of some sort, or things that looked like light balls, down to the crop right in front of their face. And two huge, twice as tall as Robert, he's 6 feet, and this thing was 2 to 3 times as tall as he was. Stan's a little guy, so he must have been really, this thing was enormous compared to Stan. Three-eyed creatures, one on either side of these two guys, as they watch this entire thing unfold right in front of their face. And that report is on the BLT website too. They should go to the page that's devoted to the Vandenbroek case, and they'll see all of these reports and so much more. It's kind of mind-boggling. If I hadn't been there personally, I've watched him take photos of my dead brother. And he never, ever met my dead brother. He didn't even know his name. And 2 months after he died, I happened to be in Holland. And he told me my brother was there. And he asked for my camera. He never uses, he only uses my camera. I come over to Europe with all the chips. I don't buy anything there. It all comes with me from the US. All the chips are labeled in my own hand. I put in a new one every day. I make notes on whatever we get every night. He never touches that camera. I've got it in a locked case until he asks me and I give it to him and I'm standing right there with him.
So I mean, even in the memory of the camera, because a lot of cameras have got their own memory, even in the actual memory of the camera, there's nothing as well.
It's blank. There's nothing in it. I check it every time. Every single morning before we go out, well, we don't go out until late, but you know, when we go out,
yeah.
I check to make sure the memory's blank. There's a brand new chip in it. Nobody touches it. Almost never take photos with it. Only Robert. And I stand right there and watch him like a darn hawk, because it's hard to believe when this first starts to happen. You think, this can't be, you know, I must be making this up. I'll send you a couple things that'll really make your eyes light up.
Definitely, and I'll put these up. See, the thing with this as well is a lot of people will say, all right, he's taken it from this photo and put it here, because they look, if you put them side by side, they're doing the same thing. What I'm wondering is he connecting with these beings, spirits, past, you know, friends and relatives, and are they projecting, or is he projecting their image onto it psychically? Has he said anything about the process? Because I've seen a couple of videos where he's, you know, they're filming him doing this, and there'll be a few photos, there's nothing, then the couple of middle ones, there's something in it, and then there's nothing again. Now,
well, I can tell you, I can give you very quickly, Robert has taken, at this point, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000, 30,000 anomalous photos. Not all with my camera. I have several thousand here. I have probably 10,000 here, but there are many other cameras. He can use any camera. You can, if you were to meet him and you brought your own camera and you simply handed it to him, when he perceives the energies are present, he has to wait until, you know, he feels the energies present. At that point, all of these things I'm sending you are linked. They're not linked to, but they're on the website. He waits until he feels the energy. Sometimes he can identify the energy. He knows that it is a deceased person, and sometimes he knows who. Sometimes he doesn't. I've been with him many times when he's used my camera, and people have appeared. We don't have the faintest idea who they are. I still don't have any idea.
And your brother's appeared on a few photos as well.
What?
Your brother's appeared on
a few. My brother appeared in over 60 photos on 2 days, because my brother, I had wanted to play some Beach Boys music. When my brother died, he loved the ocean. And I wanted to go to the ocean and play some Beach Boys music for him. And I hadn't done it by the time I got to Holland. And what happened was, the very first day I was there, he appeared in broad daylight on my camera with Robert. I'm standing there, my head is right next to Robert as he's taking the shots. I can see Bill's face coming on the LED screen over and over and over and over. And his ear was sticking out funny. His ear was sticking out in a way that it doesn't belong. And at the time I didn't realize it, but I figured that since Bill could appear in Holland, that maybe what I should do was go into town, get a Beach Boys album, and go back to this field and finally get to play him the music, because I hadn't done it. So that's what I did. I went and got the Beach Boys. We went back the next day. I put it on the car, cranked up the stereo, opened the doors, you know, and played it just for my brother, just my way of saying goodbye. He came again on the camera, and this time his ear was normal in every shot. Now, I don't know what that means, but when I thought about it, I thought, you know, maybe the only signal he knew that I wanted to say goodbye this way, maybe he couldn't go on until I had done it. And my brother, being the way he was saying, by sticking the ear out, damn it, man, go get the bloody music and play it, because I got things to do. And he's never appeared. I mean, I've been there many other times. He's never appeared again.
Yeah.
After that second time when I was playing the music, the ear went absolutely back where it should have been. It was normal then. And the feeling I had was that it sounds insane, except that if you know everything I know, it's not insane, that he was waiting for me to do this because for some reason he needed to allow me to do this. And I had taken too long. He had other things to do. Wherever it was he was, he had stuff to do. And my brother was one of those guys who likes to get on with it. And so I think he did. The only thing maybe he could do in the circumstance of not being in this body any longer was somehow or other exaggerate that ear to remind me, you know, of what I wanted to do. I wasn't consciously aware that that's what I was doing at the time. But later, after I'd done the music and saw the pictures the second time around, I thought, damn, I'll bet you he was telling me to go do that. So, I mean, I don't claim to have, I don't understand all of this. What I can tell you, absolutely, there is not one word on the BLT website that is not truthful. Not one. I have witnessed personally, taken notes, observed, documented, you know, it is all accurate. Whether it's the final answer or not, of course, I don't know. But what's there is real. And it's very strange.
Is there any other things you're working on at the moment that you can speak of? Like any new cases or an area of research you're going down that you haven't gone down before that you're looking into?
Look, we're doing some work with, there's some stuff coming out about long-term growth changes to a plants grown from crop circle seeds.
Yep, yep.
And a laboratory, Levingood and Burke. Burke has now died too. Both of them. I mean, I'm the only original BLT person left. But they were able to replicate this amazing thing we discovered, which was that when crop circles occur in grown mature crop, where the seed is completely formed when the crop circle happens, those seeds will be dehydrated. They are stunted. They look awful. But when you grow them, they grow at 5 times the rate of normal. They do it without water or sunlight for long periods of time, and they produce greater yield. This is phenomenal. It's the most important thing Levingood discovered, I think. And he and Burke were able to reproduce that effect in the lab because they built a piece of equipment that delivers these very unusual electrical pulses. And that's the thing I'm working on right now, is writing that in a way so people can understand what that means. I mean, does not change. We're GMOs, we don't need them. Yeah. We don't need pesticides. We don't need any of these things that hurt the environment. Because with this methodology, there is absolutely no effect on any of the other plants, on any creatures, any bugs, nothing. The only thing it does is increase the yield of the plants that have been, the seed that's been treated like this, and it does it much faster. I mean, the damn things grow so fast, you have trouble keeping up. And if you should happen to have a drought, it doesn't matter. Think of what this could do to the food supply around the world.
It's amazing. You know, thank God that you've looked into it and others are looking into it, and, you know, you're getting results like you're getting, and this is something you can actually show the evidence for and the research for. So with the findings of this, is this all going to be available on your website as well?
Everything is there as fast as I can get it written. Yep. Literally as fast as I can write it, it's there for free.
Fantastic.
Now, that last point you said about the money, I spent every bloody, I lived. I didn't die. Okay. This is fine. I'm glad I didn't die. But now I'm an old bat and I'm broke. Lawrence Rockefeller gave us a wonderful grant. Well, he died. I mean, he's the only Rockefeller that I know that was interested in this kind of stuff. And there have been other donors who have kept things going. I can't do this anymore. I can't on my own do it. I have to have donations. They're tax deductible. We're a 501(c). That means you can deduct anything you give to BLT, and you'll get a receipt that tells you this. You can deduct it from your taxes. But every single cent that people send really makes a difference. Because without it, I can stay right here at the computer, but I can't do much else, you know?
Yeah. No, it takes work, so and it does take money.
Send money.
Definitely. We'll wrap it up there, Nancy. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And, yeah, we'll stay in touch. But, again, thank you for what you're doing and all the work that you've done. And have a great evening.
I hope to also know more about your stuff. Is there a web? Will you send me a website link or something where I can read?
Yes, definitely. I'll send you through a link, and you can go and check all that out yourself. Everything's there.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.